Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, you can find a lot in popular culture about the generation of young people called millennials. Millennials are often described in movies and television shows as feeling entitled. They act as if they have a right to the good things in life. Many millennials also are identified as jobless and more likely than other young people to be living with one or both parents. The youngest members of this generation are in their middle 20s, while the oldest are nearly 40 years old. They lived through the Great Recession of 2007 to 2009. Many are weighed down with debt from student loans and have a hard time finding a good job in their field of study. Some were strong candidates for such jobs, but instead accepted a lower-paying position. Today, those decisions and experiences continue to affect millions of millennials. However, some young adults within the millennial age group have been able to succeed and done very well. There is a name for these young men and women: megalennials. Jason Dorsey is president and researcher at the Center for Generational Kinetics, a group based in Texas. He told VOA, "Megalennials kept working and tried pulling themselves forward in the workforce during hard economic times." Dorsey added that megalennials are now further ahead compared to the rest of their generation because they were still out there producing, doing what they could do to make it happen. There is a big difference between the megalennials and what have been called millennials. Millennials are members of the generation that have still struggled professionally and are still working on finding their place in life. What we think is fascinating is that the group of people that are most offended at work by millennials acting entitled are actually other millennials who do not feel entitled, Dorsey said. They think the rest of the generation is giving them a bad reputation. A 2019 opinion survey seems to suggest that may be the case. The survey was a project of the Business Insider website and Morning Consult, a privately held technology and media company. It found that many millennials think they are doing better than others in their generation. It showed that 46% of the millennials asked think they are somewhat or much better off financially than other members of their generation. Only 36% thought they are somewhat or much worse off. About 37% said not very good or not good at all when asked how they feel about their finances. Experts say this shows that the reality for millennials may not be quite as bad as what they are often told. So why do some millennials do well while other people in their age group did not? What we found is that they were more resilient oftentimes in their career, Dorsey noted. They also managed to keep working and building their networks and did whatever they could to keep pushing themselves forward. Dorsey added that millennials are likely to place themselves into one group or the other. He said that while megalennials and millennials share many experiences, the two groups are not likely to see themselves in each other.
Ugandan poet Stella Nyanzi was released in February after spending more than a year in prison for some words she wrote on Facebook. Uganda's government says those words insulted President Yoweri Museveni. While in prison, Nyanzi wrote a book of poems called No Roses from My Mouth. Her writings have influenced other people to use poetry to express their political opinions. Now, Uganda's government plans to appeal her recent acquittal. Before her release in February, Stella Nyanzi was serving 18 months in prison for cyber harassing the Ugandan president. She was jailed last year for writing on Facebook in 2018 that she wished Museveni had died as a fetus. She blamed him for her country's many problems. I sit on the prison beddings, spread on the floor, lean against the wall, and write whatever I please. What freedom to write, Nyanzi said. She added that her writings were often taken by prison guards during body searches. But she continued to write as a form of resistance. After her sentencing, some Ugandan writers were afraid to criticize the government. Free speech was quieted. Nyanzi supporters were pleased by her decision to use her poetry to take on politics. But others are still too frightened to publish. Danson Kahyana works for the Department of Literature at Makerere University. He says he wrote a book that he decided not to publish because he does not have the courage of Nyanzi. She's our hero. I think we shall celebrate her. One day, there will come a time when we shall say, Stella, you are the reason we are better governed, because your fighting has given us all these beautiful fruits, he said. Ugandan officials have repeatedly detained Nyanzi for criticizing Museveni, who has served as president for 34 years. Although a high court canceled the cyber harassment charge against her, Uganda's public prosecutor continues to say that Nyanzi's Facebook post was illegal. Jacqueline Okui is a spokeswoman for the prosecutor's office. She said the government is appealing the High Court's ruling and will continue bringing legal action against Nyanzi. Other poets, like Daphne Arinda, are learning what it means to try to speak freely in Museveni's Uganda. So I am terrified. I can't lie. But I also have the confidence and also the inner will to know that if I'm strong about something, then I can pursue it to its end, she said. Arinda has written poetry about Nyanzi. Nails darkened from a walk amongst trees. That's her. That's her. Ask no more who she is. Who she is, she wrote. For now, Nyanzi lives at her home, waiting for her next court appearance. No one is sure when that will be.
Government restrictions aimed at slowing the spread of the new coronavirus appear to have led to major drops in pollution levels in parts of China and Italy. Earlier this month, pollution-observing satellites over China discovered sharp decreases in levels of nitrogen dioxide, a gas that is mainly produced by motor vehicles, power plants, and factories. The satellite data was released by the U.S. space agency NASA and the European Space Agency, or ESA. There is evidence that the change is at least partly related to the economic slowdown following the outbreak of coronavirus, NASA said in a statement. The drop in nitrogen dioxide first appeared in areas around Wuhan, the city in central China where cases of the new coronavirus were first reported in December. The pollution drops then spread across the country, NASA said. Satellite images that NASA published online show pollution clouds had almost completely disappeared between January 1st and February 25th. During this period, the Chinese government shut down transportation going into and out of Wuhan and ordered local businesses to stop operating. This is the first time I have seen such a dramatic drop-off over such a wide area for a specific event, NASA air quality researcher Fei Liu said in a statement. Liu said he believes the last major drop in pollution levels over several countries came during the economic recession that began in 2008. But he said that decrease happened slowly over time. Lori Mellervita is a climate researcher with the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air in Helsinki, Finland. In a recent report on the pollution changes in China published in Carbon Brief, he wrote that electricity demand and industrial output remained far below their usual levels in several main areas. Mellervita noted a study showing that coal usage at power plants in China was down 36% in the 4 weeks after the January 25th Lunar New Year. Oil demand fell by about 34%. China's virus-fighting measures likely cut carbon dioxide emissions by at least 25% during this period, the research showed. But Mellervita told the Associated Press that he fears the pollution levels could see a sharp rise once the current crisis ends. The important question now is how China's government will respond, he said. Mellervita noted that after the 2008 to 2009 financial crisis, China attempted to make up for lost economic activity by launching massive aid programs that also supported pollution-causing industries. If such assistance happens again, it would make the environment worse long-term, he said. In Italy, the country hit hardest by the virus outside of China, ESA satellites observed drops in air pollution as well. pollution decreases were especially evident in northern Italy, where officials have ordered shutdowns aimed at reducing the spread of the coronavirus. The ESA released satellite images showing clear drops in levels of nitrogen dioxide over the Po Valley area in northern Italy. ESA's Klaus Zehner is in charge of the Copernicus Sentinel 5P satellite's operations. He said in a statement, it is possible that the satellite data could also have been affected by cloud cover and changing weather. However, he added that his team is very confident that the reduction in emissions that we can see coincides with the lockdown in Italy, causing less traffic and industrial activities. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. The House of Representatives ended the day's business early on the rainy afternoon of April 12, 1945. The House Democratic leader, Speaker Sam Rayburn, invited a friend to come by his office for a drink. "Be there around 5," Rayburn said. "Harry Truman is coming over." Harry Truman was the vice president at the time. The events are described in a book about his presidency, Conflict and Crisis, by Robert Donovan. World War II was not over yet, but it was a quiet afternoon in Washington. President Franklin Roosevelt was in the southern state of Georgia. He was resting after his recent trip to Yalta to meet with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. The president's wife, Eleanor, was at the White House working on a speech supporting the new United Nations. Harry Truman was at the Senate, but he was not interested in the debate that was taking place. He spent most of his time writing to his family back in Missouri. When the debate finished, he went to the office of House Leader Rayburn to join him for a drink. It was an afternoon Truman would never forget. Rayburn and his friend were talking in the office before Truman arrived. The telephone rang. It was a call from the White House, asking whether the vice president had arrived yet. "No," Rayburn replied. The caller asked him to have Truman telephone the White House as soon as he arrived. Truman entered a minute later. He immediately called the White House. As he talked, his face became white. He put down the phone and raced out the door to his car. Truman arrived at the White House within minutes. An assistant took him up to the president's private living area. Eleanor Roosevelt was waiting for him there. "Harry," she said, "the president is dead." Truman was shocked. He asked Mrs. Roosevelt if there was anything he could do to help her. But her reply made clear to him that his own life had suddenly changed. "Is there anything we can do for you?" Mrs. Roosevelt asked the new president. "You are the one in trouble now." Within hours, the world learned the news that Franklin Roosevelt, the longest-serving president in American history, was dead. He died of a cerebral hemorrhage, bleeding in the brain. Americans were shocked and scared. It was 1945, and the United States was still at war. Roosevelt had led the nation since early 1933. He was the only president many young Americans had ever known. Who would lead them now? All eyes turned to Harry Truman.
Our departed leader never looked backward. He looked forward and moved forward. That is what he would want us to do. That is what America will do.
Harry Truman, in his first speech to Congress as president.
With great humility, I call upon all Americans to help me keep our nation united in defense of those ideals which have been so eloquently proclaimed by Franklin Roosevelt. I want, in turn, to assure my fellow Americans and all of those who love peace and liberty throughout the world that I will support and defend those ideals with all my strength and all my heart.
Truman had been a surprise choice for vice president at the Democratic Party nominating convention in 1944. Delegates considered several other candidates before they chose him as Roosevelt's running mate. That was at a time when presidential candidates did not make their own choices for vice president. Harry Truman lacked the fame, the rich family, and the strong speech-making skills of Franklin Roosevelt. He was a much simpler man. He grew up in the Midwestern state of Missouri. Truman only studied through high school, but took some nighttime law school classes. He worked for many years as a farmer and a small businessman, but without much success. Truman had long been interested in politics. When he was almost 40, he finally won several low-level positions in his home state. By 1934, he was popular enough in Missouri to be nominated and elected to the United States Senate, and he won re-election 6 years later. Most Americans, however, knew little about Harry Truman when he became president. They knew he had close ties to the Democratic Party political machine in his home state. But they had also heard that he was a very honest man. They could see that Truman had strongly supported President Roosevelt's New Deal programs. But they could not be sure what kind of president Truman would become. History gave Truman little time to learn about his new job. The most important power he now possessed was the power of atomic weapons. And soon after he became president, he faced the decision of whether or not to use that power for the first time in history. Truman firmly believed that using the atomic bomb was the only way to force Japan to surrender. So in August of 1945, he gave the orders to drop the atomic bombs on the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Having found the atomic bomb, we have used it. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war. Only a Japanese surrender will stop us. It is an awful responsibility which has come to us. We thank God that it has come to us instead of to our enemies. And we pray that he may guide us to use it in his ways and for his purposes.
Days earlier, Truman had met in Potsdam, Germany, near Berlin, with the British and Soviet leaders, Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin, to plan the peace. The war in Europe had ended several months before.
Good evening from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, I have just returned from Berlin, the city from which the Germans intended to rule the world. It is a ghost city. The buildings are in ruins. Its economy and its people are in ruins. Our party also visited what is left of Frankfurt and Darmstadt.
We flew over the remains of Kessel, Magdeburg, and other devastated cities. German women and children and old men were wandering over the highways, returning to bombed-out homes or leaving bombed-out cities, searching for food and shelter. War has indeed come home to Germany and to the German people. It has come home in all the frightfulness with which the German leaders started and waged it.
The three leaders agreed that their nations and France would jointly occupy Germany. They also agreed to end the Nazi Party in Germany, to hold trials for Nazi war criminals, and to break up some German businesses. Foreign ministers of the Allied nations later negotiated peace treaties with Germany and other countries, including Italy, Hungary, and Romania. Eastern European nations agreed to protect the political and economic freedom of their citizens. However, Western political experts were increasingly worried that the Soviet Union would block any effort for real democracy in Eastern Europe. Truman did not trust the Soviets. And as he made plans for post-war Asia, he promised himself that he would not allow Moscow any part in controlling Japan. The leader of the American occupation in Japan was Army General Douglas MacArthur. MacArthur acted quickly to hold a series of trials for Japanese war crimes. He also launched a series of reforms to move Japan toward becoming more like a Western democracy. Women were given the right to vote. Land was divided among farmers. The idea of a national religion was ended. And the educational system was reorganized. Japan began to recover, becoming stronger than ever as an economic power. Truman and other world leaders were dealing with the problems of making peace. But at the same time, they were also trying to establish a new system for keeping the peace. The United States, the Soviet Union, Britain, and the other allies had formed the United Nations during wartime. But soon after Truman took office, they met in San Francisco to discuss ways to make the United Nations a permanent organization for peace. In July of 1944, many of the world's top economic experts met to organize a new system for the world economy. They gathered at a hotel in Bretton Woods in the American state of New Hampshire. They created the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to help nations rebuild their economies. At the center of all the action was Harry Truman. It was not long before he showed Americans and the world that he had the ability to be a good president. He was honest, strong, and willing to make decisions. I was sworn in one night, and the next morning I had to get right to the job at hand, Truman remembered years later. In an oral history recorded with the writer Merle Miller, Truman said, "I was afraid, but of course I didn't let anybody know that. And I knew that I would not be called on to do anything that I was not able to do. That's something I learned from reading history." Truman spoke of how people in the past had much bigger problems. Somehow, he said, the best of them just went ahead and did what they had to do. And they usually did all right.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.